the book was done, and she'd said she wanted me to come to Baltimore and read it to her, so I could talk her through the hard parts. I'd called several times since to plan the visit, but she hadn't returned my calls. I left messages, but didn't push her. She needs some space to prepare herself, I thought. She'll call when she's ready. When I got home from Clover, I called again, saying, I brought something back for you from Clover. You won't believe what's happened down there. But she didn't call back. On May 21st, 2009, after leaving many messages, I called again. Her voicemail box was full. So I dialed Sonny's number to say something I'd said to him many times over the years. Will you tell your sister to stop messing around and return my calls? I really need to talk to her. Our time is running out. When he answered the phone, I said, Hey, Sonny, it's Rebecca. And for a moment, the line went silent.
I've been trying to find your phone number, he said,
and my eyes filled with tears. I knew there was only one reason Sonny would need to call me. Deborah had gone over to her niece's house on Mother's Day, a week and a half before my call. Sonny had made crab cakes for her, the grandchildren were there, and everyone laughed and told stories. After dinner, he took Deborah back to the apartment she loved and said goodnight. She stayed home the next day, ate the leftover crab cakes Sonny sent home with her, and talked to Davon on the phone. He was learning to drive and wanted to come over in the morning to practice. The next morning when he called, she didn't answer. A few hours later, Sonny dropped by to check on her, as he did nearly every day, and found her in her bed, arms crossed on her chest, smiling. He thought she was sleeping, so he touched her arm, saying,
Dale, time to get up.
But she wasn't sleeping.
She's in a better place now, Sonny told me. A heart attack, just after Mother's Day. She wouldn't have wanted it another way. She suffered a lot in life, and now she's happy.
After finding Deborah in her bed, Sonny cut a lock of her hair and tucked it inside their mother's Bible with the locks of hair from Henrietta and Elsie.
She's with them now,
he told me.
You know there's no place in the world she'd rather be.
Deborah was happy when she died. Her grandson, little Alfred, was now 12, headed into the 8th grade and doing well in school. Lawrence and Bobette's granddaughter, Erica, had gotten into Penn State after writing an admissions essay about how her great-grandmother Henrietta's story had inspired her to study science. After transferring to the University of Maryland, she earned her bachelor's degree and entered a master's program in psychology, becoming the first of Henrietta's descendants to attend graduate school. At 17, Deborah's grandson Davon was about to graduate from high school. He'd promised Deborah he'd go to college and continue learning about Henrietta until he knew everything there was to know about her.
That really made me feel okay about dying whenever my time come, she'd told me.
As Sonny told me the news of Deborah's death, I sat staring at a framed picture of her that's been on my desk for nearly a decade. In it, her eyes are hard, her brow creased and angry. She's wearing a pink shirt and holding a bottle of pink Benadryl. Everything else is red, her fingernails, the welts on her face, the dirt beneath her feet. I stared at that picture for days after her death as I listened to hours of tape of us talking and read the notes I'd taken the last time I saw her. At one point during that visit, Deborah, Davon, and I sat side by side on her bed, our backs to the wall, legs outstretched. We'd just finished watching two of Deborah's favorite movies back to back, Roots and the animated movie Spirit, about a wild horse who's captured by the U.S. Army. She wanted us to watch them together so we could see the similarities between the two. Spirit fought for his freedom just as Kunta Kinte did in Roots, she said.
People was always trying to keep them down and stop them from doing what they want, just like people always doing with me and the story about my mother, she said.
When the films ended, Deborah jumped out of bed and put in yet another video. She pressed play, and a younger version of herself appeared on the screen. It was one of nearly a dozen tapes the BBC had recorded that didn't make it into the documentary. On the screen, Deborah sat on a couch with her mother's Bible open in her lap, her hair brown instead of gray, her eyes bright, with no circles beneath them. As she talked, her hand stroked the long lock of her mother's hair.
I often visit her hair in the Bible, Deborah said into the camera. When I think about this hair, I'm not as lonely. I imagine, what would it be like to have a mother to go to laugh, cry, hug? God willing, I can be with her someday. I'm looking forward to that.
The younger Deborah said she was glad that when she died, she wouldn't have to tell her mother the story of everything that happened with the cells and the family, because Henrietta already knew.
She's been watching us and seeing all that's going on down here, Deborah said. She's waiting patiently for us. There won't be any words, just a lot of hugging and crying. I really believe she's up in heaven, and she's doing okay, because she did enough suffering for everyone down here. On the other side, they say there's no pain or suffering. I want to be there with my mother.
Sitting between me and Davon on the bed, Deborah nodded at her younger self on the screen and said,
Heaven looks just like Clover, Virginia. My mother and I always loved it down there more than anywhere else in the world.
She stroked Davon's hair.
I don't know how I'm going to go, she said. I just hope it's nice and calm. But I tell you one thing. I don't want to be immortal if it mean living forever. 'Cause then everybody else just die and get old in front of you while you stay the same. And that's just sad.
Then she smiled.
But maybe I'll come back as some HeLa cells like my mother. And that way, we can do good together out there in the world.
She paused and nodded again.
I think I'd like that.
Where they are now. Alfred Carter Jr., Deborah's son, is in prison, serving a 30-year sentence for robbery with a dangerous and deadly weapon and first-degree assault with a handgun. While incarcerated, he went through drug and alcohol rehabilitation, got his GED, and taught GED classes to other inmates for $25 a month. In 2006, he wrote to the judge who sentenced him, saying he wanted to pay back the money he stole and needed to know who to send it to. Dr. Sir Lord Keenan Kester Cofield's whereabouts are unknown. Most recently, he served several years in prison for trying to buy jewelry at Macy's with a stolen check and filed several lawsuits while incarcerated. In 2008, after being released from prison, Cofield filed a 75-page lawsuit, his last to date, that a judge called incomprehensible. He sued 226 parties for more than $10 billion and argued that past decisions in all his cases should be reversed in his favor and that anyone who printed his name without permission should be included in his suit because he'd copyrighted his name. I was never able to get in touch with him to interview him for this book. Cliff Garrett, Henrietta's cousin, lived in his farmhouse in Clover until 2009, when his failing health required him to move in with his son in Richmond, Virginia, where he currently lives. HeLa is still one of the most commonly used cell lines in laboratories around the world. When this book went to press in 2009, more than 60,000 scientific articles had been published about research done on HeLa, and that number was increasing steadily at a rate of more than 300 papers each month. HeLa cells are still contaminating other cultures and causing an estimated several $1 million in damage each year. Howard Jones, Henrietta's doctor, is an emeritus professor at Johns Hopkins and Eastern Virginia Medical School. He founded the Jones Institute for Reproductive Medicine in Norfolk, Virginia, with his late wife, Georgiana. They were pioneers in the field of infertility treatments and were responsible for the first test tube baby born in the United States. When this book went to press, he was 99 years old. Mary Kubitschek is retired and living in Maryland. Zakaria, Sonny, and Lawrence Lax were deeply affected by Deborah's death. Lawrence charged more than $6,000 to his credit cards to cover the cost of her burial. And when this book went to press, Sonny was saving money to buy her a tombstone. Zakaria stopped drinking and began studying the lives of yogis and others who'd achieved inner peace. He started spending more time with his family, including his many nieces and nephews, who hug and kiss him on a regular basis. He smiles often. Sonny has sworn to uphold Deborah's desire to gain recognition for their mother. Today, when the Lax brothers talk about Henrietta, they focus on the importance of her contribution to science. They no longer talk about suing Johns Hopkins, though Lawrence and Zakaria still believe they're owed a share of the profits from HeLa cells. Christoph Langauer is global head of oncology drug discovery at Sanofi Aventis, one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. Many of the scientists working for him use HeLa cells on a routine basis. He lives in Paris, France. Davon Mead and little Alfred Jr., Deborah's grandsons, live in Baltimore, as do 22 of Henrietta's other descendants, including her grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Two others live in California. John Moore appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which refused to hear his case. He died in 2001. Roland Petillo is a professor at Morehouse School of Medicine, where he continues to hold his HeLa conference in Henrietta's honor each year. Petillo and his wife, Pat, plan to buy a marker for Henrietta's grave to be placed near her mother's tombstone in the Lax family cemetery. James Pullum, Deborah's ex-husband, is still preaching in Baltimore. Courtney Speed still runs her grocery store, where she continues to teach local children to do math and hopes to open a Henrietta Lax Museum. Afterward. When I tell people the story of Henrietta Lax and her cells, their first question is usually, wasn't it illegal for doctors to take Henrietta's cells without her knowledge? Don't doctors have to tell you when they use your cells in research? The answer is no. Not in 1951, and not in 2009 when this book went to press. Today, most Americans have their tissue on file somewhere. When you go to the doctor for a routine blood test or to have a mole removed, when you have an appendectomy, tonsillectomy, or any other kind of ectomy, the stuff you leave behind doesn't always get thrown out. Doctors, hospitals, and laboratories keep it, often indefinitely. In 1999, the Rand Corporation published a report, the first and so far last of its kind, with a conservative estimate that more than 307 million tissue samples from more than 178 million people were stored in the United States alone. This number, the report said, was increasing by more than 20 million samples each year. The samples come from routine medical procedures, tests, operations, clinical trials, and research donations. They sit in lab freezers, on shelves, or in industrial vats of liquid nitrogen. They're stored at military facilities, the FBI, and the National Institutes of Health. They're in biotech company labs and most hospitals. Biobanks store appendixes, ovaries, skin, sphincters, testicles, fat, even foreskins from most circumcisions. They also house blood samples taken from most infants born in the United States since the late 60s, when states started mandating the screening of all newborns for genetic diseases. And the scale of tissue research is only getting bigger. It used to be some researcher in Florida had 60 samples in his freezer, then another guy in Utah had some in his, says Kathy Hudson, a molecular biologist who founded the Genetics and Public Policy Center at Johns Hopkins University and is now chief of staff at NIH. Now we're talking about a massive, massive scale. In 2009, the NIH invested $13.5 million to develop a bank for the samples taken from newborns nationwide. A few years ago, the National Cancer Institute started gathering what it expects will be millions of tissue samples for mapping cancer genes. The Genographic Project began doing the same to map human migration patterns, as did the NIH to track disease genes. And for several years, the public has been sending samples by the millions to personalized DNA testing companies like 23andMe, which only provide customers with their personal medical or genealogical information if they first sign a form granting permission for their samples to be stored for future research. Scientists use these samples to develop everything from flu vaccines to penis enlargement products. They put cells in culture dishes and expose them to radiation, drugs, cosmetics, viruses, household chemicals, and biological weapons, and then study their responses. Without those tissues, we would have no tests for diseases like hepatitis and HIV, no vaccines for rabies, smallpox, measles, none of the promising new drugs for leukemia, breast cancer, colon cancer. And developers of the products that rely on human biological materials would be out billions of dollars. How you should feel about all this isn't obvious. It's not as if scientists are stealing your arm or some vital organ. They're using tissue scraps you parted with voluntarily. Still, often that involves someone taking part of you. And people often have a strong sense of ownership when it comes to their bodies, even tiny scraps of them, especially when they hear that someone else might be making money off those scraps or using them to uncover potentially damaging information about their genes and medical histories. But a feeling of ownership doesn't hold up in court. And at this point, no case law has fully clarified whether you own or have the right to control your tissues. When they're part of your body, they're clearly yours. Once they're excised, your rights get murky. Kathy Hudson, who has conducted focus groups about the public's feelings on the tissue issue, says she believes that tissue rights have the potential to become a bona fide movement. "I could see people starting to say, 'No, you can't take my tissues,' she told me. 'All I can say is, we better deal with the problems now instead of waiting until that happens.'" There are, essentially, two issues to deal with: consent and money. For most people, knowing if and how their tissues are being used in research is a far bigger issue than profiting from them. Yet when this book went to press, storing blood and tissues for research did not legally require informed consent, because the law governing such things doesn't generally apply to tissue research. The Federal Policy for the Protection of Human Subjects, also known as the Common Rule, requires informed consent for all human subject research. But in practice, most tissue research isn't covered because, one, it's not federally funded, or two, the researcher never learns the identity of the donors or has firsthand contact with them, in which case it's not considered research on humans. So in the end, The common rule doesn't actually govern most tissue research. Today, if doctors want to gather tissues from patients strictly for research purposes, as in Henrietta's case, they are required to get informed consent. But storing tissues from diagnostic procedures, like, say, mole biopsies, and using them in future research doesn't require such consent. Most institutions still choose to get permission, but there's no uniformity in the way that's done. A few hand out enough information to fill a small book, explaining exactly what will be done with all patient tissues. But most just include a short line in an admission form saying that any tissues removed may be used for education or research. According to Judith Greenberg, director of the Division of Genetics and Developmental Biology at the National Institute of General Medical Science, the NIH now has very stringent guidelines, requiring consent for any tissues collected for their banks. It's very important for donors to understand what the consequences of tissue research might be, she says. But their guidelines apply only to NIH research, and they're not legally binding. Supporters of the status quo argue that passing new tissue-specific legislation is unnecessary, and that the current oversight practices are enough. They point to institutional review boards, the many professional guidelines, like the American Medical Association's Code of Ethics, which requires doctors to inform patients if their tissue samples will be used in research or lead to profits, and several post-Nuremberg codes, including the Declaration of Helsinki and the Belmont Report, all of which list consent as a requirement. But guidelines and ethical codes aren't laws, and many tissue rights supporters say internal review doesn't work. Beyond simply knowing their tissues are being used in research, some tissue rights activists believe donors should have the right to say, for example, that they don't want their tissues used for research on nuclear weapons, abortion, racial differences, intelligence, or anything else that might run contrary to their beliefs. They also believe it's important for donors to be able to control who has access to their tissues, because they worry that information gathered from tissue samples might be used against them. In 2005, members of the Native American Havasupai tribe sued Arizona State University after scientists took tissue samples the tribe donated for diabetes research and used them without consent to study schizophrenia and inbreeding. Their case is still pending. In 2006, some 700 new mothers found out that doctors had taken their placentas without consent to test for abnormalities that might help the hospital defend itself against future lawsuits over birth defects. And in a handful of cases, genetic tests performed on people without their consent have been used to deny workers' compensation or health insurance claims, something now protected against by the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2008. Because of cases like these, a growing number of activists, ethicists, lawyers, doctors, and patients are arguing cases and pushing for new regulations that would grant people the right to control their tissues. And a growing number of tissue donors are suing for control of their samples and the DNA inside them. In 2005, 6,000 patients demanded that Washington University remove their tissue samples from its prostate cancer bank. The university refused, and the samples were tied up in litigation for years. So far, two courts have ruled against the patients, relying on the same logic used in the Moore case, that giving patients those rights would inhibit research, etc. In 2008, the patients appealed to the Supreme Court, which refused to hear their case. When this book went to press, they were contemplating class action. Most recently, in July 2009, parents in Minnesota and Texas sued to stop the nationwide practice of storing and conducting research, without consent, on fetal blood samples, many of which can be traced back to the infants they came from. They argue that research on those samples is an invasion of their children's privacy. Because of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, of 1996, there is now clear federal law in place to prevent the kind of privacy violation that happened to the Lacks family when doctors at Hopkins released Henrietta's name and her medical records. Since tissues connected to their donors' names are subject to strict regulation under the Common Rule, samples are no longer named using donor initials as Henrietta's cells were. Today, they're usually identified by code numbers. But as Judith Greenberg of the NIH says, it's never possible to 100% guarantee anonymity, because in theory, we can now sequence genes and find out who anyone is from their cells. So the consent process has to be more about laying out the risks of tissue research so people can decide whether they want to participate. Ellen Wright Clayton, a physician and lawyer who is director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society at Vanderbilt University, says there needs to be a very public conversation about all of this. She says, if someone presented a bill in Congress that said, as of today, when you go to the doctor for health care, your medical records and tissue samples can be used for research and nobody has to ask you, if the issue were stated that bluntly so people could really understand what's happening and say they're okay with it, that would make me more comfortable with what we're currently doing. Because what's happening now is not what people think is going on. Lori Andrews, director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology, wants something more drastic. She has called for people to get policymakers' attention by becoming conscientious objectors in the DNA draft and refusing to give tissue samples. David Korn, vice provost for research at Harvard University, argues that giving patients control over their tissues is short-sighted. Sure, he says, consent feels nice. Letting people decide what's going to happen with their tissues seems like the right thing to do. But consent diminishes the value of tissue. To illustrate this, Korn points to the Spanish flu pandemic. In the 1990s, scientists used stored tissue samples from a soldier who died in 1918 to recreate the virus's genome and study why it was so deadly, with hopes of uncovering information about the current avian flu. In 1918, asking that soldier's permission to take tissues for this kind of future research would have been impossible, Korn says. It was an inconceivable question. No one even knew what DNA was. For Korn, the consent issue is overshadowed by a public responsibility to science. I think people are morally obligated to allow their bits and pieces to be used to advance knowledge to help others. Since everybody benefits, everybody can accept the small risks of having their tissue scraps used in research. The only exception he would make is for people whose religious beliefs prohibit tissue donation. If somebody says being buried without all their pieces will condemn them to wandering forever because they can't get salvation, that's legitimate, and people should respect it, Korn says. But he acknowledges that people can't raise those objections if they don't understand their tissues are being used in the first place. Science is not the highest value in society, Andrews says, pointing instead to things like autonomy and personal freedom. Think about it, she says. I decide who gets my money after I die. It wouldn't harm me if I died and you gave all my money to someone else. But there's something psychologically beneficial to me as a living person to know I can give my money to whoever I want. No one can say she shouldn't be allowed to do that with her money because that might not be most beneficial to society. But replace the word money in that sentence with tissue, and you've got precisely the logic many people use to argue against giving donors any control over their tissues. Wayne Grody, director of the Diagnostic Molecular Pathology Laboratory at the University of California, Los Angeles, was once a fierce opponent of consent for tissue research. But after years of debating people like Andrews and Clayton, he's become more moderate. I'm pretty convinced that we should go the extra mile to have a good and complex consent process, he told me. Still, he can't imagine how it would work. These tissues enter a pipeline of millions of other samples, he said. How are you going to distinguish, well, this patient said we can study colon cancer, the next one said we can do anything we want, but we can't commercialize it? I mean, do they all have to be color-coded? Regardless, Grody stresses that questions of consent should apply only to the collection of future samples, not the millions already stored, including HeLa. What are we going to do? He says. Throw them all out? If the issue of consent isn't addressed, Robert Weir, founder of the Biomedical Ethics Center at the University of Iowa, sees only one outcome. Patients turn to law as a last resort when they don't see their participation being acknowledged. Weir favors fewer lawsuits and more disclosure. Let's get these things on the table and come up with legal guidelines we can all live with, he says, because going to court is the only other option. And court is where these cases often end up, particularly when they involve money. When it comes to money, the question isn't whether human tissues and tissue research will be commercialized. They are and will continue to be. Without commercialization, companies wouldn't make the drugs and diagnostic tests so many of us depend on. The question is how to deal with this commercialization, whether scientists should be required to tell people their tissues may be used for profit, and where the people who donate those raw materials fit into that marketplace. It's illegal to sell human organs and tissues for transplants or medical treatments, but it's perfectly legal to give them away while charging fees for collecting and processing them. Industry-specific figures don't exist, but estimates say one human body can bring in anywhere from $10,000 to nearly $150,000. But it's extremely rare for individual cells from one person to be worth millions, like John Moore's. In fact, just as one mouse or one fruit fly isn't terribly useful for research, most individual cell lines and tissue samples aren't worth anything on their own. Their value for science comes from being part of a larger collection. Today, tissue supply companies range from small private businesses to huge corporations like Ardeus, which pays the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Duke University Medical Center, and many others an undisclosed amount of money for exclusive access to tissues collected from their patients. You can't ignore this issue of who gets the money and what the money is used for, says Clayton. I'm not sure what to do about it, but I'm pretty sure it's weird to say everybody gets money except the people providing the raw material. Various policy analysts, scientists, philosophers, and ethicists have suggested ways to compensate tissue donors, creating a Social Security-like system in which each donation entitles a person to increasing levels of compensation, giving donors tax write-offs, developing a royalty system like the one used for compensating musicians when their songs are played on the radio, requiring that a percentage of profits from tissue research go to scientific or medical charities, or that all of it be funneled back into research. Experts on both sides of the debate worry that compensating patients would lead to profit seekers inhibiting science by insisting on unrealistic financial agreements or demanding money for tissues used in non-commercial or non-profit research. But in the majority of cases, tissue donors haven't gone after profits at all. They, like most tissue rights activists, are less concerned about personal profits than about making sure the knowledge scientists gain by studying tissues is available to the public and to other researchers. In fact, several patient groups have created their own tissue banks so they can control the use of their tissues and the patenting of discoveries related to them. And one woman became a patent holder on the disease gene discovered in her children's tissues, which lets her determine what research is done on it and how it's licensed. Gene patents are the point of greatest concern in the debate over ownership of human biological materials and how that ownership might interfere with science. As of 2005, the most recent year figures were available, the U.S. government had issued patents relating to the use of about 20% of known human genes, including genes for Alzheimer's, asthma, colon cancer, and most famously, breast cancer. This means pharmaceutical companies, scientists, and universities control what research can be done on those genes and how much resulting therapies and diagnostic tests will cost. And some enforce their patents aggressively. Myriad Genetics, which holds the patents on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes responsible for most cases of hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, charges $3,000 to test for the genes. Myriad has been accused of creating a monopoly, since no one else can offer the test, and researchers can't develop cheaper tests or new therapies without getting permission from Myriad and paying steep licensing fees. Scientists who've gone ahead with research involving the breast cancer genes without Myriad's permission have found themselves on the receiving end of cease and desist letters and threats of litigation. In May 2009, the American Civil Liberties Union, several breast cancer survivors, and professional groups representing more than 150,000 scientists sued Myriad Genetics over its breast cancer gene patents. Among other things, scientists involved in the case claim that the practice of gene patenting has inhibited their research, and they aim to stop it. The presence of so many scientists in the suit, many of them from top institutions, challenges the standard argument that ruling against biological patents would interfere with scientific progress. Lori Andrews, who has worked pro bono on all of the most important biological ownership cases to date, including the current breast cancer gene suit, says that many scientists have interfered with science in precisely the way courts always worried tissue donors might do. "It's ironic," she told me. The Moore court's concern was, if you give a person property rights in their tissues, it would slow down research because people might withhold access for money. But the Moore decision backfired. It just handed that commercial value to researchers. According to Andrews and a dissenting California Supreme Court judge, the ruling didn't prevent commercialization. It just took patients out of the equation and emboldened scientists to commodify tissues in increasing numbers. Andrews and many others have argued that this makes scientists less likely to share samples and results, which slows research. They also worry that it interferes with healthcare delivery. There is some evidence to support their claim. One survey found that 53% of laboratories had stopped offering or developing at least one genetic test because of patent enforcement, and 67% felt patents interfered with medical research. Because of patent licensing fees, it costs $25,000 for an academic institution to license the gene for researching a common blood disorder, hereditary hemochromatosis, and up to $250,000 to license the same gene for commercial testing. At that rate, it would cost anywhere from $46.4 million for academic institutions to $464 million for commercial labs to test one person for all known genetic diseases. The debate over the commercialization of human biological materials always comes back to one fundamental point. Like it or not, we live in a market-driven society, and science is part of that market. Baruch Blumberg, the Nobel Prize-winning researcher who used Ted Slavin's antibodies for hepatitis B research, told me, "Whether you think the commercialization of medical research is good or bad depends on how into capitalism you are." On the whole, Blumberg said, commercialization is good. How else would we get the drugs and diagnostic tests we need? Still, he sees a downside. "I think it's fair to say it's interfered with science," he said. "It's changed the spirit. Now there are patents and proprietary information where there once was free information flow. Researchers have become entrepreneurs. That's boomed our economy and created incentives to do research. But it's also brought problems like secrecy and arguments over who owns what. Slavin and Blumberg never used consent forms or ownership transfer agreements. Slavin just held up his arm and gave samples. "We lived in a different ethical and commercial age," Blumberg said. He imagines patients might be less likely to donate now. "They probably want to maximize their commercial possibilities, just like everyone else." All the important science Blumberg has done over the years depended on free and unlimited access to tissues. But Blumberg says he doesn't think keeping patients in the dark is the way to get that access. For somebody like Ted, who really needed that money to survive, it would have been wrong to say scientists could commercialize those antibodies, but he couldn't. You know, if someone was going to make money off his antibodies, why shouldn't he have a say in that? Many scientists I've talked to about this issue agree. "This is a capitalist society," says Wayne Grody. "People like Ted Slavin took advantage of that. You know, the way I see it is, if you think of doing that on the front end, more power to you." The thing is, people can't think of doing that on the front end unless they know their tissues might be valuable to researchers in the first place. The difference between Ted Slavin, John Moore, and Henrietta Lacks was that someone told Slavin his tissues were special and that scientists would want to use them in research, so he was able to control his tissues by establishing his terms before anything left his body. In other words, he was informed and he gave consent. In the end, the question is how much science should be obligated, ethically and legally, to put people in the position to do the same as Slavin. Which brings us back to the complicated issue of consent. Just as there is no law requiring informed consent for storing tissues for research, there is no clear requirement for telling donors when their tissues might result in profits. In 2006, an NIH researcher gave thousands of tissue samples to the pharmaceutical company Pfizer in exchange for about $500,000. He was charged with violating a federal conflict of interest law, not because he failed to disclose his financial interest or the value of those tissues to the donors, but because federal researchers aren't allowed to take money from pharmaceutical companies. His case resulted in a congressional investigation and later a hearing. The possible interests of the patients and their lack of knowledge of the value of their samples wasn't mentioned at any point in the process. Though the judge in the John Moore case said patients must be told if their tissues have commercial potential, there was no law enacted to enforce that ruling, so it remains only case law. Today, the decision to disclose this information is up to the institution, and many choose not to tell their patients. Some consent forms don't mention money at all. Others come right out and say, "We may give or sell the specimen and certain medical information about you." Others simply say, "You will receive no reimbursement for donating tissue." Still others embrace confusion. Your sample will be owned by the university. It is unknown whether you will be able to gain, participate in, any financial compensation, payment, from any benefits gained from this research. Tissue rights activists argue that it's essential to disclose any potential financial gain that might come from people's tissues. This isn't about trying to get patients a cut of the financial action, says Lori Andrews. It's about allowing people to express their desires. Clayton agrees, but says, "The fundamental problem here isn't the money. It's the notion that the people these tissues come from don't matter." After the Moore case, Congress held hearings and commissioned reports that uncovered the millions of dollars being made from human tissue research. And it formed a special committee to assess the situation and recommend how to proceed. Its findings, "The use of human cells and tissues in biotechnology holds great promise for improving human health, but raises extensive ethical and legal questions that have not been answered," and to which no single body of law, policy, or ethics applies. This, they said, must be clarified. In 1999, President Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Committee, NBAC, issued a report saying that federal oversight of tissue research was inadequate and ambiguous. It recommended specific changes that would ensure patients' rights to control how their tissues were used. It skirted the issue of who should profit from the human body, saying simply that the issue raises a number of concerns and should be investigated further. But little happened. Years later, I asked Wayne Grody, who was in the thick of the debate in the 90s, why the congressional recommendations and NBAC report seemed to have vanished. "It's weird, but I have no idea," he said. "If you can figure that out, I'd like to know. We all just wanted to forget about it. Like if we ignored it, maybe it would just go away." But it didn't. And given the steady flow of court cases related to tissues, the issue isn't going away anytime soon. Despite all the other cases and the press they've received, the Lacks family has never actually tried to sue anyone over the HeLa cells. Several lawyers and ethicists have suggested to me that since there is no way to anonymize HeLa cells at this point, research on them should be covered by the common rule. And since some of the DNA present in Henrietta's cells is also present in her children, it's possible to argue that by doing research on HeLa, scientists are also doing research on the Lacks children. Since the common rule says that research subjects must be allowed to withdraw from research at any time, these experts have told me that in theory, the Lacks family might be able to withdraw HeLa cells from all research worldwide. And in fact, there are precedents for such a case, including one in which a woman successfully had her father's DNA removed from a database in Iceland. Every researcher I've mentioned that idea to shudders at the thought of it. Vincent Racaniello, a professor of microbiology and immunology at Columbia University, who once calculated that he's grown about 800 billion HeLa cells for his own research, says that restricting HeLa cell use would be disastrous. "The impact that would have on science is inconceivable," he said. As for the Lackses, they have few legal options. They couldn't sue over the cells being taken in the first place for several reasons, including the fact that the statute of limitations passed decades ago. They could attempt to stop HeLa research through a lawsuit, arguing that it's impossible to anonymize Henrietta's cells, which contain their DNA. But many legal experts I've talked with doubt such a case would succeed. Regardless, the Lackses aren't interested in stopping all HeLa research. "I don't want to cause problems for science," Sonny told me as this book went to press. "Dale wouldn't want that. And besides, I'm proud of my mother and what she'd done for science. I just hope Hopkins and some of the other folks who benefited off her cells will do something to honor her and make right with the family." What follows is an interview with the author Rebecca Skloot.
Hi, this is Kelly Gilday, producer of the audiobook The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and we're here speaking with the author Rebecca Skloot. Rebecca, this book weaves Henrietta's story and the story of her family with the science of HeLa. Had you always planned to tell her story this way, or did the structure of the book develop organically?
The structure of the book, I definitely didn't plan to tell it that way necessarily. And I wish I could say it developed organically. It was a long, torturous process. But what happened was that as I started kind of going through, as I was researching the book and as I was sort of developing the story in my head, I realized that the book was in some ways as much, if not more, about Deborah and her struggle to understand what happened to her mother and to learn about her mother as it was about Henrietta. And for readers, I was very sort of aware of the fact that if you picked up this book and you just started reading from the beginning with Henrietta going to the hospital and sort of going chronologically forward, you wouldn't meet Deborah until the final section of the book, and it would suddenly become a very different book. It would suddenly be this book about her daughter. And so I wanted readers to know right when they picked up the book, this is not your average science book. This is not just a history of these cells. There's going to be a lot of different voices, and there's this other character who's actually a main character. And so I struggled a lot with how to bring Deborah into the story early on. I started the book with many different chapters. At one point, I had the kind of faith healing that happens with her cousin Gary as the first chapter, which didn't work at all, and because I wanted readers to be able to see, oh, there's something totally different coming down the road. And so that's where the idea for the structure came from, was essentially wanting to let readers, and wanted readers to be able to essentially learn both of the stories at the same time, because as you learn the Lax's story, you really, the story of Henrietta takes on so much more weight because you sort of understand how much, what impact it had on her family and all that. So that's where the idea for the structure came from. And then I spent much time with index cards on a huge blank wall, moving things around and trying to sort of figure out a way to braid those two stories together that wouldn't lose people, you know, jumping around in time and different characters and all of that. So it was it happened organically, but with a lot of intention.
When you set out on this journey to expose the true backstory behind Hela, did you know that the Lax family would become such an integral part of that story?
I had no idea. I had always been interested in her family, and I had always been curious about what their reaction was to the cells, but I had no idea what they'd really been through. And so I just had no concept that their story was as kind of involved as it was as difficult as it was, or as such an important part of the story of the cells. I kind of went into it thinking I was sure they would have some interesting things to say about their feelings about their mother's cells being alive all these years after her death, but I didn't have any concept of how, of what that story might be. And I really thought the book would be about Henrietta and herself, basically a sort of biography of the two of them with some bits of the story of her family in there, until that first phone call. And I called Deborah that very first time, and we had this, and she did this sort of almost manic brain dump where I just said, you know, I basically introduced myself, and she talked about all these things, and I didn't understand most of them. They were all little bits of things. Somebody had murdered somebody. Somebody tried to steal something having to do with her mother. There were all these sort of hints at this bigger story, and hearing those little snippets, but also just the absolute sort of terror in her voice and how she obviously desperately wanted to talk about this stuff and wanted to know about this stuff, but was also very scared. That was the moment when I went, oh, this is a much bigger story than just a story about these cells. Something happened to this family, and I don't understand what it is, but I have to find out. And that's when the book sort of went off in that other direction.
You hit so many roadblocks along the way, many put up by the Lax family themselves. Did you ever come close to quitting, and what compelled you to stay so persistent?
Amazingly, no. I didn't ever come close to quitting. I definitely got frustrated along the way, and I definitely wondered if I was ever going to be able to finish. I kind of envisioned myself at 60 still working on this book, but I never considered stopping. And I think a lot of that, you know, had to do with my feelings about how important the story was to tell. And it's such an important story in the history of medicine that hadn't been told, and I really felt strongly about getting that out there. I felt that telling the story of Henrietta Lacks was incredibly important and all that. But in a lot of ways, the thing that actually kept me going, and, you know, when I started to feel really kind of almost beaten down by the story, was talking about it. I would, you know, I'd go to, whether I was at a party or in a coffee shop, sort of wherever I would meet people, you know, it always comes up, what do you do? I'm a writer working on a book. Oh, what's your book about? And whenever I told people the story, their reaction was just, they were stunned. and they were filled with questions. You know, was it legal for them to take these cells? And what did all this mean for the family? And watching the way that people reacted to the story whenever I talked about it really helped keep me going. And a lot of writers talk about the fact that they don't talk about books as they're working on them. They say, you know, I've heard many writers say it's sort of when you tell the story out loud, it can kind of weaken the story as you write it. They worry that it'll be less fresh on the page if they've talked about it a lot. And for me, it was exactly the opposite. The more I talked about it, the more I was sort of revitalized by the people and the way that they heard the story as I told it. And the questions they would ask would sort of keep a lot of the information of the story fresh in my head. And each time I told the story, I'd tell it a little bit differently. And so that response from, and whether they were scientists or a friend of the family or sort of whoever it was that I was telling the story to, it really kept me going because it reminded me why I was doing this. Like, I was doing this because it's an important story and people react so intensely to it because it is so powerful and sort of important.
While exploring Henrietta's life and the history of Gila, what was the most exciting discovery you came across?
Okay, the most exciting discovery was that moment of sort of discovering Dr. Patillo and then having him put me in touch with Deborah. Because that was really, for me, that was the moment where I thought, oh, this is actually going to happen. This could actually be a book. And the moment that I hung up the phone with Deborah, that very first conversation we had, I hung up the phone and I was actually I was working at the University of Pittsburgh at the time, and it was after hours, so I didn't know anyone was even in the building. And I hung up the phone and I screamed at the top of my lungs. I was so excited and sort of terrified. And I was like, oh my God, I felt like I'd gotten myself into something that was much bigger than I could really understand at that moment. And so I just put down the phone and screamed really loud, and I didn't know my boss was there. And she came running down the hall thinking someone was attacking me. And I just couldn't, I was sort of hopping up and down and running in circles. I was just so excited that I had finally gotten to talk to Deborah and that it felt like the book was really going to happen. So in terms of excitement, I think that was really the moment for me. I don't know that it's a discovery necessarily, but it was certainly the most, I screamed. So.
And what was the most upsetting discovery?
The discovery of what happened to Deborah's sister. Neither one of us expected that. And, you know, I went into the story, and Deborah went into the sort of process of doing this with me, knowing that her mother had had a very painful death, and we were sort of prepared for anything we found in the medical records. But the moment when Paul Lurs pulled out the autopsy report and we saw the picture of Deborah's sister, and that was one of the most devastating moments sort of my life, and it was really... It was a very traumatic picture to look at, but also just realizing that there was a horrible story behind it, and also worrying very much about Deborah and sort of wanting to protect her from it, but knowing that I couldn't because she was right there with me in the moment it happened. And then the more we looked into that, the more we learned about it, the worse it was. And then after the fact, I did a lot of research and talked to various people and found that Elsie had been used in those research studies without her knowledge, or without the family's knowledge, and that those were actually incredibly painful, unpleasant things for her to have gone through. And that really was the most deeply disturbing thing that I came across in the research process.
The death of Deborah really takes the listener's breath away. Can you describe your feelings toward the project upon learning of Deborah's passing? Did it give it more gravity?
You know, I think it'll take me probably a long time to really, in some ways, even be able to wrap my mind around the fact that she's gone. That was utterly devastating for me. She and I had gotten very close over the process of my working on the book all of these years, and it was unexpected, but it was also not a huge surprise. I mean, I knew she had had a stroke in the past, and you know, I knew that she had blood pressure problems and things, but I wasn't ready for it. In a lot of ways, it was my worst fear come true because, you know, that she used to tease me all the time because it took so long to do this book. And she would joke around and say, you know, you better finish this thing before I die because I want to see it. And we would laugh. And then in the end, she didn't get to see it. She died the She actually died the day that the book went on pre-sale. The day that people could start ordering the book online was the day that she died. And she was never able to actually hold the book in her hand. She was never able to flip through the pages and read some of it. And that was very hard for me. And at the same time, she knew what was in the book. We had talked through a lot of it, and I felt like she had, I don't feel like, her death sort of prevented her from learning the story from others. She obviously did that as we were sort of traveling and doing some of the research together. But yeah, it takes on a gravity, and her absence is very present for me whenever I do anything, any interview I do, any public appearance, and she's sort of there with me in my head, she wanted very badly to go out and talk to people about the book, and she would have been so excited to hear people's responses. And so that, it gives me, in a sense, the gravity of, it makes, I guess, oh, I might have to sort of think about this. I think part of what it does is that it doesn't so much increase the gravity of the book, but it does make me feel like it does sort of increase the gravity of my need to go out and talk about it. Because she so wanted to do that. She just wanted to travel. She wanted to go on TV shows. She wanted to go meet people in bookstores and just talk to them about her mother. Because that was, her whole life. No one would talk to her about her mother. And now, after the book comes out, everybody wants to talk about her mother. And the fact that she isn't able to be there for that is very sad. But at the same time, I know that she would be thrilled by the interest and by the fact that people are finally talking about her mother. And in some ways I feel like she decided not to actually read the book, because I had finished a draft of the manuscript long before she died and called her and said, okay, it's done. And we had talked about whether I was going to read it to her. She didn't want to read it herself because we were both worried that she would have a hard time with some of the information in the book and that it might cause her to get sick again. And so we had had this plan where I was going to read it to her and then sort of omit certain points and say, okay, here's the part where, your mother's dying and it's pretty painful. Do you want me to read it to you, or do you want me to just sort of skip this part because we know what happened? And we were actually in the process of planning the trip where I was going to go to read it to her when she died. And she'd been sort of putting it off a little bit to say, okay, yeah, we're going to do it. Let's plan it. And I think she was sort of not quite ready for it. And so the fact that she died before we had that moment, I almost feel like she sort of made a decision that she just sort of wanted the book, she wanted to let go of the book and let it go out in the world without her actually reliving it all again. For me, Deborah is still incredibly alive. I have all these tapes of us talking, and I listen to them periodically, and I have videos, and she's in my head, and she has lived in my head for the last 10 years, and I hear her voice all the time. And for me, it's very, I feel like I haven't quite accepted the fact that she's actually dead. And it really, in some ways, feels very appropriate with her story and with her mother's story, because that's the same way that she felt about her mother. In some ways, her cells were still alive. She was gone, but she wasn't gone. And there was some part of her that was still so present in the world and is still so present in the world. And so I have that same experience with Deborah, and I hope that readers will too, that she's very much alive for me. When I go to Baltimore now, there's a side of me that sort of expects that she's going to be there. And I think that in some ways, as I go and travel and talk about the book, I imagine that the realization that she really is gone will hit me at some point. But in some ways, I feel like even that, it's like, she's not really gone. there's this sort of, she's here and she's not here. And, her death happened very late in the book process. I had worked on the book for almost 10 years, and it was finished. I had written an ending. It was done, and it was basically going through the editing process to be published when she died, and then I had to essentially rewrite the end of the book to include her her death and the sort of what followed. And that was a sort of amazing thing of having to go back and essentially open the book back up again and say, wait, the story wasn't actually over. And in some ways, that feels appropriate too, for Deborah, this sort of idea that, the story never really ends because the cells never die, and Deborah will sort of always be here, her in her voice and through her story.
What is the most important lesson you'd like listeners to take away from this book?
The answer to that sort of varies depending on who the listener is. You know, for scientists, this story is incredibly powerful because it's this reminder of the fact that there is a human being behind every single tissue sample, every, you know, gene they work with in the lab, and that those people and their families often have lives and experiences associated with those samples that, after the fact, that scientists don't usually know about. I mean, most scientists who read the book, many of them have said to me, I've been working with HeLa my entire career, and I never thought to ask where they came from. I just never even wondered who this person was. And for them, it's a very transformative experience, a lot of them. And so I hope there's a part of the book that, in terms of that readership, that's definitely one of my goals, is I hope that they come away with this, sort of looking at tissue samples in a slightly different way as bits of people with stories. And for the general public, you know, what I don't want them to take away from the book is that tissue and cell and tissue research is bad. That was one thing that I was very concerned about as I was writing the book, because I tried very hard to strike a balance where I showed the incredible promise of cell and tissue culture and how much of medicine and our lives rely on research on these tissues. And, you know, often people hear this, and sometimes people hear the story of Henrietta and they say, oh, I'm not going to let doctors take my cells and do things with them. It sounds very nefarious and scary. And, you know, I want people to, in a sense, I want readers to learn about the complexity of the issues behind cell and tissue culture, that it's so incredibly important for medicine and for our health, and at the same time that it raises some issues that everyone should be aware of and that people, you know, should be thinking of in terms of, okay, so we do need this science to happen. What kind of regulations or what kind of procedures do we need in order to make it so that can happen in a way that's good for everyone? So that's definitely part of what I hope readers take from it. And also just, you know, the importance of communicating about science. You know, in a lot of ways, this book is about a lack of communication and inability for scientists to explain things on a level that's basic enough for the general public to understand them. And also, you know, a lack of sort of education enough to really understand some of the science. And the ways in which science sort of can affect our daily lives are vast, and there are so many different reasons why it is important for people to be able to talk about science and for scientists to be able to talk about it in a way that's accessible to the general public, and also for regular folks who sort of feel like, oh, science, I don't know anything about science, I don't like science, it's sort of, but to sort of be open to learning a bit about science and the way that it impacts our lives.
Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for taking time today to talk to us about your new audiobook.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. Read by Cassandra Campbell with Bonnie Turpin. Executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2010 by Rebecca Skloot. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.